5 minutes past nine. Hello, I'm Rebecca Levingston. Hope you're settling into your long weekend. Maybe you've got some plans to head to the beach or go camping. Whatever it is you're doing, I hope it's in a relaxed fashion. It's amazing what makes people happy. You're about to hear from two blokes who say that chicken poo and worm mansions are at the very heart of what gives them great pleasure. They call themselves the urban farmers, but they live a long, long way from the land. Their story coming up for you very, very shortly.
Welcome to the Urban Farmers. My name is Jim Kiernan.
And I'm Joel Bensley.
And Joel and I created the Urban Farmers as a way we could share and document our experiences as we convert our life from the busy urban workaholics that we are into something of more of a self-sufficient and sustainable situation that we would like to move into.
That's the idea behind it.
Now, recently we had a bit of surprising news or surprising little occurrence happened to us. We were actually contacted by ABC Brisbane Radio, our local station, and they had heard about our website and invited us onto their show for an interview.
Yeah, it was really good fun, actually, going into the studio and having a bit of a yarn.
Yeah, and it all happened so quick, too, because, you know, we got the email at about 10 o'clock on a Wednesday evening, and then Thursday morning I contacted Rebecca Levingston, who is the host of the evening program on ABC 612 ABC Brisbane. And yeah, she said her producer showed her the website and they wanted us on, and then they said to me, how about you come in at 9 o'clock and we'll be on at 9:30.
And we got in at 9 o'clock and we were on at 4 minutes past nine.
Yeah, it just sort of happened real quick.
It did. The guns were blazing.
Yeah, I was a little nervous about it, to be honest. Just, I think, purely because we were just rushed straight into it. But it went really well.
It did go well. Yeah, she was a lovely, lovely girl. And, it was...
She held her hand through it. And
she didn't hold mine.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what happens under the desks. No, we're just kidding. But no, it was good, and we'll actually post it at the end of this audio diary so you guys can have a listen if you didn't catch it. But it was a bit of good exposure, but also a really good experience for us. And I think, you know, somewhat of a added advantage that we had was doing these audio diaries where we had a bit of, slight experience in talking to nobody, with the thought that perhaps a lot of people are listening, so.
It really drummed it home to me, Jimmy, that, you know, more and more people are getting on the bandwagon, and there is a real swing, a real trend it's going back to the grassroots. And, you know, I've said it, you know, in the last couple of audio diaries, and I probably mentioned it on the radio as well, that, you know, it wasn't that long ago that most people had chooks and a veggie patch in the backyard, and then for a long time it was lost, but it really is coming back more than ever, I reckon. It really is kicking off, and it's exciting, you know?
Yeah, and before we started recording, you mentioned something about a newspaper article. Can you shed some more light on that for us?
Yeah, well, I mean, I got the chooks from a place just local in my area in Brisbane, and Heritage Poultry, and we're actually going to get yours from there in the coming weeks, and I spoke to the bloke there, and hopefully we're going to get a bit of that on film, and we can post a video of that.
Yeah, that'd be good, actually.
Get
some info right from the source, from the professionals.
That's right, but it said in this article, I think it was interviewing, I'm sorry, I don't know his name, but his wife, and she was saying that, in, you know, 2 years ago they were selling on average 200 laying hens a month, and now they're selling between 800 and 1,000 a month. So
that's just baffling, right?
It really is, you know, and, you know, over the last couple of months in the papers there's been more articles about people growing vegetables and people wanting to be a bit more self-sufficient and having, you know, more of an idea where their food comes on from and taking a bit more responsibility and having gardens and veggie patches on balconies or wherever you can fit one and also having chooks. And, you know, it's really exciting, mate. You know, it's something that a lot of people are interested in And the more that are interested in it, the better, because, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And I think even, as I mentioned on the radio interview, but it's not even about completely, you know, replacing the trip to the supermarket. It's about supplementing, but also about having more of a respect for where your food comes from and what goes into actually, you know, producing that food. And, you know, it's something that I've really gained out of it as well, is a big respect for organic farmers and, you know, those guys and girls out there actually doing it commercially. You know, the amount we're paying for fruit and vegetables in the store, it isn't really that expensive when you consider what amount of work goes into it. But so I just wonder how much the farmers are actually getting out of it.
Yeah, well, when you see, signs up at fruit shops and that sometimes off the side of the highway, and you know, you can buy onions for 9 cents a kilo or something like that, you got to wonder what the farmer's getting out of that at the end of the day. But you made a good point there. I think it is unrealistic to think that you can just, you know, flick a switch and be completely self-sufficient. I think for the major majority of us, you know, that isn't an option to just walk away from the supermarket. But like you say, supplementing what you can gives a tremendous amount of satisfaction, even if it's just a few herbs growing that, you know, you can just pick some fresh herbs to throw in, you know, a spaghetti bolognese or whatever it is. The little bit that you can do gives great rewards. It's
Know what? I think it's good to grow a variety of things, but if you find you're good at growing one thing, or you tend to eat a lot of a particular type of vegetable, if you can concentrate, you know, a bit of effort towards that one crop, like potatoes, for instance. I love potatoes. I eat a lot of potatoes. And, you know, if I can grow enough potatoes to supplement that and that alone, well, that's just one less thing that I'm buying, you know. So
yeah, that's right. And tomatoes is another one that I think, you know, when you grow your own tomatoes, and they can be a little bit fiddly sometimes, but when you get it right and you get those beautiful vine-ripened tomatoes off your own plant, and you can eat them within, you know, 5 minutes of ripping it off the plant,
there's a significant beautiful difference between the type of flavour and produce that you get from a homegrown tomato than you do in the store.
Absolutely. A lot of the ones now in the store are just insipid, you know. They might look fantastic, but, the flavour and the body is just not there, whereas the one you grow at home might not, it's probably not perfectly round. They often, it's funnily enough, when you grow them yourself, they don't ever seem to be that perfect, picture-perfect tomato, but the flavour's just, that's so what good. It's all about at the end of the day, and, you know, it is, yeah, it's worth doing.
It is what it is, and, you know, I grew those beefsteak ones, and, you know, I was cutting bits off the tomato where, you know, some bugs had gotten to it and stuff like that. The rest of it was good.
And the funny thing is, like, if you go to the supermarket, you'll pick up a piece of fruit or vegetable, and you'll spin it around, and you'll feel how firm it is, and if it's got even the slightest blemish, you'll put it back, and you'll grab another one, whereas you rip something off one of your own plants in the backyard, and you're far more tolerant of,
that's right,
of imperfections, and, you know, it makes you aware of things like that. But like you say, that it's respect funny. You've got for organic farmers and the effort that they put in to get something.
Absolutely.
It's only when you start growing something yourself and you're not dousing it with herbicides and pesticides that, you know, all of a sudden you realise it's getting eaten by every living thing under the sun.
That's right. Yeah, it's pretty hard to protect it.
Yeah, so when something finally does come good, you know, you're pretty keen to get it in your gob.
Who cares? It's got a bit of brown in it. It's funny you say that, because we're drinking a quiet little gin and tonic here, and I bought the limes before. And I did exactly that. I was in the supermarket and I was spinning them around, and that one's not green enough to
It's human nature. Yeah.
But you're right. You do that in the store, you don't do it at home.
No. And I think it's good, because it makes you aware that, you know, not everything is perfect.
You shouldn't worry yourself with that sort of stuff.
It's more grounding.
Yeah, absolutely. So potatoes, I mentioned, I actually, you know, obviously this is one of my first failures, and we did mention and have mentioned in the past that we'll share our failures as well as our successes. And I must admit, I completely fouled up with my potatoes.
They looked the goods.
They sure did.
But they didn't bring home the potatoes.
Yeah, they They were... I don't know if I can get past that.
Back on track. Let's move on.
Yeah. No, you're right. The plant grew beautifully. It looked wonderful. And then, you know, as expected, the plant died off. And then when I dug down, there was absolutely no potatoes in there whatsoever. And that's because I planted them at the wrong time.
Yeah, well, that's... I mean, they just looked like they were going gangbusters. And, yeah. And they were. But yeah. Like you've said, they only produce a potato at a certain time of year. We were talking about this off air just before, so do you want to share what you mentioned with me? I found it really interesting.
Yeah, so the potato is actually, or the part of the potato plant which we get the potato from, it's actually a the plant's ability to store energy, pretty much. So, of course, the greenery of the plant is the plant itself, but then when it comes time to prepare itself over the winter months, it actually starts to develop the tubers, which is the potato itself. A lot of people think of it as a root, but it's actually not. It's actually a tuber.
Oh, right.
Well, to the best of my limited knowledge, but basically what the plant's doing is it's storing energy in the potato. All of the greenery of the plant will actually die off over winter, and it stores all this energy in the potato itself. And then, like when you chit a potato and it starts to grow the plant again.
Did you say chit?
I did say chit. that is it, the plant actually regrowing for its, you know, second time around, or third or fourth or fifth. So, you know, we as humans cultivate potatoes, and a lot of people don't realise that they are a perennial. So they're not an annual plant that just grow one crop and then die off and then you replant later.
Yeah, that is interesting.
The plant actually, if left in the wild, it grows the plant, it dies back but stores its energy in the potato, and then the potato re-chits itself underground, regrows the plant and keeps on going. So it is actually a perennial plant, which I was, you know, shocked to find out, but
yeah,
that's what it
true.
Is.
Yeah, true. No, that is interesting.
Yeah, so planting and chitting my potatoes and then planting them during summer or the beginning of summer was absolutely wrong time. So my plant grew beautifully, but it didn't need to store any energy because, you know, obviously it was a healthy plant. And then when it started to get cool, as it's starting to now, it died off and there was, you know, nothing there. It was a fully grown plant. So, but... funnily enough, I've been chitting a few different varieties of potatoes, and I know you have as well.
I've got a couple on the go at the moment.
Yeah. What types have you got? Good question.
Yeah, a red one and a white one. So I think it's a Desiree and just
standard,
like
cream.
Yeah, I don't know. They call them a washed potato at the supermarket.
Yeah, just a regular one.
Yeah, I can't. Okay. I don't know what they're... The specific breed.
Yeah, I always remember when I'm collecting them, and then I put them in my I actually rest them in an egg carton, and that's
how
I sort of store.
Yeah, it's a good system
them.
You've got there.
And then I forget what they are. I remember I've got a Desiree. I think I've got one called a blue something. But yeah, I love the potato. I don't really pay too much attention with it, which is silly, really, because if you like them, you should use them. But I do have the Kipflers as well, which is my favourite potato, those little fingerling ones.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they look good, yeah.
Yeah, so I've got three varieties and you've got two. So I had been growing them in a bag, an old potting mix bag, 65-litre potting mix bag. Once I'd used all the potting mix, I had only a little bit left, I planted them in there, and that system worked very well. But now with the amount of potatoes I want to do... I just didn't have that many bags around, but I did see those potato bags that you can buy, and they were quite cheap. It's only about $12 for two, so...
Yeah, that is good. And this is another point that, you know, even if you live in a unit and have just a balcony, is the only place you get that has a bit of sun, you can still grow potatoes in a bag really successfully if you plant them at the right time of year.
That's right, and that's... Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, and the thing is that potatoes are highly productive as well, so... A 65-litre bag of potato, 65-litre bag growing potatoes in should produce a fairly bumper crop of potatoes. So, and they store really well. They keep for a long time if you put them in the right conditions, you know, somewhere without moisture, nice and dry and cool, and they last for a long time. So, and apparently leaving you know, leaving some of the dirt on them, not washing them. They do last a lot longer as well.
And they seem to have more flavour. Like, I've always thought that, you know, the supermarket, you've normally got the two standard varieties, and one will be a washed potato, and it's, you know, Schmicko clean, and then there's the brushed potatoes that are normally cheaper.
Yep.
They do last a lot longer. Mm-hmm. They definitely last a lot longer. But, you know, once you, if you just scrub it, you know, with a bit of steel wool or something like that, just loosely to get the dirt off and then bake that. Or even if you peel it, they always have more flavour.
Yeah, they do.
I don't know what the process is of getting it to that primo, clean, washed look, and if there's some sort of light bleaching or something involved in it. But I've always felt that a brushed potato's got superior flavour to a washed potato.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that's essentially what we want to replicate. And we'll do a little video of that. The bags that I've got, as well as the home brand version of it that I did before.
Yeah, we'll definitely get that on film, because it's
so easy to do.
And it just worked a treat. Like, yeah. Obviously getting the timing right's key, but that's something we've learned along the way. When you get that timing right, you know, and kick a goal, you'll have a bag full of spuds there.
Yeah, you grow your own sack of potatoes.
Yeah, that anyone can do, even on the balcony.
Yeah, so I think that's...
Or in a little courtyard.
Yeah, the only thing with growing that size is potentially for people who might have issues lifting, you know, such a big bag around or anything like that.
Yeah, well, I suppose when that bag's fully loaded, 65 litres, it's, you know, it's a bit of weight there.
It sure is, yeah. So I hate just carrying the 65 litre bag of potty mix to the car when I buy it, but, you know, I guess I'd find some extra strength if I knew it was full of potatoes.
Yeah.
All right, so... Couple other things that I've been doing, dude. I want to try my hand at blackberries.
Beautiful.
Or some kind of berry.
Mm.
Now, this is going to be touch and go, because in Queensland, I don't know how well they're going to grow, because I believe that traditionally they're accustomed to a cooler climate.
Yeah, they do. You do seem to hear about them more being down south.
Yeah. I did read, though, that there's two types of blackberry. One's a little bit more freestanding, and the other one's more of a runner type vine.
Yeah, right.
Style. And I believe, from what I read, that the one that supports itself is a lot hardier in cooler conditions than the runner one. So I've got the runner one.
In cooler conditions or warmer conditions? Oh, sorry, yep. Okay. Yeah, hard, so you've got the runner one that hopefully will withstand a bit more of the
warmer
temperatures we experience up here.
Yeah, so, and like all things, when you're reading about them, it's always, in Australia, we have a healthy set of knowledge published that seems to all revolve around New South Wales and Victoria in the cooler states. So it does say it needs, you know, full sun, but in Queensland full sun usually means death.
Yeah.
So
yeah, well, all we can do is give it a crack, mate, you know. I mean, if it comes good, it's great. Another one that I know that does grow well in our climate here is mulberries, which is very similar.
Yeah,
and they're absolutely beautiful. There's obviously quite a few different varieties of mulberries. And I know this is a bit of a segue off the blackberry topic, but mulberries, I love mulberries. They're so beautiful. And when I was on my trip recently around Australia, my uncle was growing some in WA, and they were a white mulberry.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I'd never seen them before, and they were completely white. And he said it's good because, you know, the kids don't stain their clothes when they're woofing into them. But I must admit, it didn't have, to me, quite the flavour that the other varieties have. But, yeah, it was still really interesting to see, and it was lovely to try them.
That's odd. I'd never heard of it either, so I'd love to try one. But
yeah, well, yeah. Geraldton, yeah, it's only about, I don't know, 5,000 k's away.
Still. I'd love to, actually, it'd probably look good in a tart or something, where you've got, like, half of the white ones and half of the blackberries and type mulberries.
Yeah, it's like when you see, like, a roasting tin full of the mixed colours of the carrots and stuff. Yeah, to have that variance. And there is different flavours there. It would be, yeah, it's cool. So maybe something we can look into. If the blackberries don't work out this time, give the mulberries a crack and see how they go up here. But hopefully, fingers crossed,
we'll
blackberries work out.
Yeah, otherwise it's just, you know, $12 down the drain.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's what you do.
Nothing for a corporate high flyer like you.
Oh, please, stop it. I'll never live that down. Now, another thing as well that we're doing, and this is I guess good for others without much space as well. We actually bought some little rails that we could hang some baskets off for the kitchen.
Awesome.
Our kitchen windows are north facing, so we did get a fair bit of sun through it.
Perfect. Yeah.
Which you couldn't ask for more, really. But we wanted to hang these baskets and then put some little herbs in there as well. So probably not going to be overly productive because the pots are quite small. But we do have enough space for six different herbs. And I think it'd be great for those occasions where you're cooking something up and you don't feel like running down to the garden to get a particular herb. And if you've got it there and you only need a little bit, you know, pluck a few bits off. So.
Yeah, no, awesome. Fresh herbs in cooking, it's so good. And, you know, having them there at your fingertips in the kitchen is awesome. And you know, for a lot of us, the reality is, growing them in a kitchen on a windowsill or something like that is one of the only areas that people have. But it's also a productive way of growing them if it's set up right. So it'll be good to see how that goes. You know, a lot of people have a planter box outside the kitchen window or something like that, and they can just slide the screen across or push the window
and
open.
Reach out
and pick some. So, yeah, and look, it looks great in the kitchen too, having a bit of colour and a bit of life in the kitchen.
Real plants.
Yeah. Awesome.
So the six we picked, I'll see if I can remember them off the top of my head. I'm not very good at remembering stuff. We've got thyme, basil, sage.
Garlic chives.
Two more.
Was it coriander?
No. Paul, my brother, would kill me if I put coriander in the kitchen.
Okay.
As much as I love it and have
you are
24 trays of the stuff out there. But no, it's...
I can't remember. You only just rattled them off just before downstairs, but...
yeah, another couple, but... yeah, it should be pretty good. So we'll take some photos and I might... Once I've got a bit of foliage on them and set them up, I'll take some photos and do a little post on it.
Yeah, no, good work. That's exciting to have them in the mix.
Yep. Now, I did a bay tree as well.
Fresh bay is magic. It really is lovely in cooking. When I was growing up, my mum and dad used to always have some dried bay leaves in the cupboard. And
I was always amazed by it, really.
Yeah, and to be honest, I never sort of, until I was an adult, saw it in its, like, fresh state.
Mm.
And, well, many years ago, I bought a bay tree and planted it, and it stayed the same size for about 4 years. and it stayed healthy and looked great, but it literally grew maybe an inch in 4 years.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't work out what was going on. I was wondering if it was some weird graft of another plant that was... I mean, it would have been an excellent bonsai, I think, because it just didn't bloody move.
Except did you pick many of the leaves off of it?
I picked a few, but I stopped in the end because it wouldn't move. I didn't want to leave it as just a few twigs there. But my uncle actually had one in the ground, and I saw it just recently. It's only been in the ground for a year or two, and it was about 6 foot tall. So
does he pick it quite often? Or did he just plant it and leave it?
I'd say he's got a real green thumb. He's got a fantastic garden, so I don't think he's put a huge amount of effort into it, but he probably prepared the soil well, and I basically just pulled it out of the pot and banged it in the ground when I did it. But yeah, they're renowned for being slow growing, but one, I don't know, I'll have to try and twist his arm and find out what his secret was, because it really took off, and it's a beautiful one to use in cooking.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. It's really good with fish, and I just bought a little barrel planter box and put it out on the veranda. And I know, you know, what you're saying, how slow growing they are, and to the point that Paul and I actually went through all of the bay plants and we picked two or three of what we thought was the biggest and put them next to each other, and it's almost like we had the ruler out trying to measure and count the leaves to pick the one that the most
got the verniers out on the trunk to see which one had the most girth.
You know, even to the point where the one we've got at the moment's a little bit taller, but another one was a little bit shorter but had more developed branches, and, you know, it was a toss-up. Do we go with the one with more branches, or do we go with one that's a little bit taller, and in the end, the height won, so...
I'll be interested to see how it goes. It looks great in that pot, by the way, and this is one of the great things about, you know, having plants that produce fruit or vegetables or herbs in a pot that, you know, you can, it's ornamental and it serves a purpose, a culinary purpose. So that's fantastic. But I'll be really keen to see how that bay tree goes. I mean, you've put it in there with good potting mix and, you know, you'll give it a bit of TLC. And maybe it was the fact that I did very little with the one that I put in the ground, and it was just straight into the existing dirt with no improvements of any variety, that it didn't do much. And, perhaps, and possibly with a bit of effort and that you've put into putting the right gear in there, that it might come good quicker.
Yeah, we'll see. So, we'll take a little photo of that and maybe just pop it onto Twitter or something like that.
Yeah, sure.
Mm. Now, while we're on the topic of gardens, and, you know, we've harped on a bit about herbs, which I think is the first step for anyone who wants to give this sort of thing a bit of a go.
It's a good way to whet your appetite.
Yeah, and particularly it's so versatile in the kitchen as well. Mm. You know, you can keep buying everything you usually do, but then just sprinkle a bit of herbs on it. I mean, I cooked some leeks before, and you know, just put in a bit of just coriander through it or something like that. It just improves it so much. So.
Mm. And there's pretty much anyone you meet has got one or two herbs in particular that they really... really are keen on, and you know, there's so many to choose from. So yeah, even if they just want to, it's a good way to get you know, get started.
And that's exactly what I've done here. So we know that I'm now in my new house, which I'm lucky enough to purchase just recently, and I've had to pretty much start from scratch. So obviously, the first thing I did was get some herbs going.
Yeah.
But I am looking at obviously my situation and what I can do, and I've been here for 2 weeks now, and I've done a fairly good site analysis of what I can and can't do. And for location, as in space, but also accessibility to water, and most importantly, the sun direction, particular spot that I've got mapped out for my garden beds, it is absolutely the best spot for it, except for the soil. So,
well, I suppose, yeah, that's the difficulty, and we all, I suppose, have obstacles and hurdles to overcome in our own, you know, backyard or whatever our growing area can be. But there's a way around it.
That's right. So to bring everyone up to speed, basically, the house I purchased had an area that was devoted to a fairly large jungle gym for the kids of the previous occupants. Now, the people who owned this house prior did nothing in halves. They did everything to the best that they could. And for this particular spot, they've actually, when I dug down on the area, the jungle gym's gone now, but the spot is absolutely ideal for the garden beds, but also absolutely ideal for some chickens as well. It's a fairly large area, and one area of it is fairly well shaded, and that is where the chickens are going to go.
Yep.
But the area that is sufficient enough to get three raised garden beds in, or three garden beds originally is what I was thinking, about 3 meters long and a meter wide, so by three, so fairly decent area for production. And when I dug down, basically what I found was about 5 to 6 inches of small chipped bark, which was used as the floor of the play area. And I thought, well, okay, bark isn't so bad because it starts to degrade. And
it takes time, depending on how finely it's chipped. But, yeah, but it does eventually break down.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this stuff was about a centimetre by a centimetre square cut bark. So it's fairly fine, really. Mm. So I thought, you know, this is going to be great. I'm going to dig down. It's going to be nice and
mulch down
underneath the top layer. And I'm going to have some really good soil underneath there. Unfortunately, what I found underneath the 5 to 6 inches of bark was crushed blue rock.
Crusher dust,
basically. Mm. Which, you know, turned...
It's ideal for compacting.
Yeah.
Under roads.
Yeah.
Which is what it's used for.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's great for what they used it for, obviously. However, for what I want to use the area for is far, far from ideal. So the only way I can get around it is to actually build the same beds, other than look at a different location.
Or get a machine in and go to great expense of shifting soil and getting soil in.
Yeah, which
you know,
Yeah, it's not going to happen. So I think I'm going to leave everything the way it is, and whether this is right or wrong, but I think at least the bark area is going to provide some good drainage underneath some soil.
It absolutely will, yeah.
But I'm going to build the same beds, 3 meters long by a meter wide, three of them, and I'm going to build them around 400 high.
So yeah, which is two sleepers.
Yeah, two sleepers
high. Yeah, no, that I think that's a good result, and you know, raised beds are proven; they've been used all around the world, and you know, it'll be really interesting to see what kind of results you get. Like you say, you'll have excellent drainage there. You having raised beds, you'll be bringing soil in, obviously, to fill in there. So you'll be getting good soil to go in there to start with.
Well, that's
true. And you can mix
in
your different mediums, like manures and whatever else you want to mix into them. And I think we'll get some good results with them.
Yeah. We'll just give it a crack and see how we go. And the good thing about a raised garden bed is if I'm struggling to grow anything in it, I can always put another level onto it without too much of a fuss. So
yeah, for sure.
Which makes work a little bit easier as well, because you're not having to bend over as much.
And the other good thing about the raised beds is that some veggies and fruit do better with, for instance, like horse manure or cow manure, and some do better with chicken manure or blood and bone and other things. And, you know, you can separate off beds. You can have, with your three different beds, you can have one that's got, you know, a certain one in it. Yep. So one will be good for growing carrots, where another one might be good for growing lettuce or broccoli or something like that, whatever they happen to be. You're not just governed with having all the same soil in the ground. You can sort of tailor it to suit.
Although in saying that, and what you say is right for a season, but I think what I'll end up actually doing is, and this is where I came up with the number of three beds, because there is actually space to put a fourth one in if I really wanted to. But three beds works really well because in one season I can actually separate, just like what you're saying, but put brassicas in one, legumes in another, and root vegetables in the third.
Right.
Now, obviously, those different varieties of plants need certain elements, just like you were saying, but they also extract all those elements out, and if you keep planting the same crops in that same area, then it just devoids the soil of those nutrients that they need.
Yeah, it leaches out specific things for the specific varieties.
Yeah, so, you know, setting them up, as you were saying, is going to be great, but then what I can actually do is move, you know, just rotate it, so, you know, move them all down one and then move one up, and you know, the legumes are really good because they put nitrogen back in the soil, whereas, you know, your brassicas and things like that, which take nitrogen out. So once the brassicas move on to the next bed, they've leached you know, devoided the soil of a lot of its nitrogen, and then you're putting the legumes in there and they're putting that nitrogen back into the soil. So
that's
crop rotation works really well. So
beautiful.
And because they all get similar sun patterns as well, the crop rotation's not going to be too much of an issue as far as changing the plant's condition, because they are all sitting right next to each other. So I'm only going to have around 500 mil between each bed as well, so just enough to walk down and et cetera, et cetera.
Great.
Now, another thing about the situation, I mentioned lightly that getting water to the situation as well is something of an advantage, and the reason that is that I've actually identified an area where I'm losing water. And when I say losing water, this is rainwater capture.
Yeah.
So I do have a 5,000 gallon tank, which captures the majority of my water. However, my double garage and part of my veranda ceiling are all plumbed into the one drain, which is not going towards the tank.
Yeah.
So we looked at that a bit earlier, but what I'm going to do is get a rain capture barrel and just siphon the water off of those downpipes into the barrel. And then because where the barrel will sit and where it's actually draining off is actually higher than where the beds are, I don't need a pump or anything, or a ram pump. I can just use gravity to my advantage.
Yeah, the head that the water will have in that tank will be able to just, either you can just irrigate with it, or you could put an underground like soakage system in that it just leaches into the soil under its own gravity at a slow rate, keeping it moist. And
so do you think with that, obviously still want to use the tap, because when it's raining, I'll turn it off because I want to collect the water. And obviously, where I have the soaker hose is getting rain directly from the sky.
Yeah, well, obviously, the type of soaker hose that I'm talking about lets water out very slowly.
Okay.
So it's not like it's just, if it's raining, it's just going to be flowing through there. It soaks out. So in a typical Queensland Brisbane storm here, you know, that 1,000-litre barrel will just be overflowing straight down, and we'll have an overflow off that going back into the stormwater drain.
Yeah.
But I don't think that you'll need to isolate it with a tap. We'll have a look. There's a few different soakage systems there. Like you say, when it's raining, it's getting it but from the sky. But irrigation hose that's underneath, it very slowly leaches out of there. It's literally like there's a couple of different ones. One's a drip system that it just drips out, and there's another one that it sort of almost sweats out of the...
Oh, that's
slow. Yeah, it's that slow.
Okay, so it's not going to make a big difference.
And what we'll have to look is whether that will be suitable if the gravity's got enough pressure to come out of that sweating type hose, or if that does need to come off mains pressure or a pump line.
Oh, okay, of course, yeah.
And I think that it might do, just thinking this through now, and we might be better with just the drip line system. Mm.
Or I'll just use a hose and use it as a...
Yeah.
Just for filling my water... what do you call those things? Watering can.
Yeah.
Or something like that, perhaps. So, I mean, that I think that water-saving barrel... A lot of people can't necessarily have the space to put in big tanks like a 5,000... I'm very fortunate to have enough space to put a 5,000-gallon tank.
Mm, 5,000 gallons is a... It's a good amount of water storage there.
Mm, I wish it was full, but that's another story. However, the water barrels, they're only about, what would you say, maybe 500 mil in diameter? And about
about that,
1.2 high or 1
mil about high? 1,200 high, yeah.
About 1,200 high. So, I mean, anyone can put one of those next to... I mean, surely you can find a downpipe or even a few to put them near. And, you know, that just that simple method gives you that much more water to utilise in your garden that's otherwise just going straight down the drain.
Yeah, no, that's right.
So I think when we kick that off, I think we'll probably look at doing that in about a month's time. We'll do a little video on that as well and share that with the listeners. And
yeah, it's easily done. Just a couple of fittings off a downpipe can normally tee it in, even if you're just doing like... it as a temporary measure. If you're renting a house or you're in some sort of temporary accommodation, you know you can normally do it without destroying the existing infrastructure there, and still when you go you can take it with you and just reinstate the downpipe
and it gives you plenty of water even if you're in a unit or something like that. Usually your downpipes run by the balcony if you've got a balcony or something like that.
And look, even if you don't have a downpipe on your balcony, a lot of these units now have got air conditioning, and you can tap onto the condensation line off an air conditioning unit and catch that water.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. Mm. I know at my parents' house, we've got plants sitting underneath all the condensation lines.
Yeah, absolutely. In the humidity that we have in Queensland, the air conditioners produce a lot of condensation and... Mm. You know,
it's like magic, isn't it?
It's a
water
it's a
from air.
Good use of that as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. And there's ways that we can look all around to save water, and I think that's our most valuable asset.
It's adapting our modern lifestyle in a way that we can still get back to the grassroots and like mesh together.
Mm, that's a good point. Now, speaking of temporary locations, renting and things like that. We know that obviously I've moved to this place and I was doing a bit of gardening in the last place.
Yeah, so what happened there? did you pull up roots and save what you could? Or?
Yeah, well, I did take some stuff with me that was in portable containers. I did have a styrofoam box, you know, like the veggie one that we talked about last time that was with the worm farm, which... I'm going to give a crack sometime soon. I've got one of those with carrots, which I took with me, and all my potted plants, my chilies, and all that sort of stuff. And admittedly, I started raising seeds in seed pots and stuff, trying to time it right so that they're becoming good just as I'm moving, so that I can get them in the ground straight away, try and minimise that downtime between locations. But I fortunately, I can keep going back to the place that I was living at. And I went back, and of course, I'm the enthusiastic gardener, and no one had been looking after the plants when I got there, and the list was the tomatoes were dead, the purple king climbing beans were almost dead, the snow peas were well and truly gone.
Oh, that's disappointing.
The lettuce was gone, the beetroot was struggling but hanging on, carrots were just hanging on as well. My strawberries, which were in a pot, which I should have taken with me to begin with, they were pretty much dead, but I've managed to save them. There's just enough foliage on them to cut all the dead stuff away, give them a drink, and bring them back to life. So hopefully I've saved those. And, you know, it's my own fault. I'm not putting any blame on the previous... on anyone at the place there. I'm just saying...
But you know who you are.
Yeah. Yeah, there really wasn't many people there. But, I mean, 2 weeks in the Australian summer with no water, and particularly, and I might add, a garden that was used to getting regular water.
Yeah, yeah, and that makes a difference,
which,
yeah.
Which in itself can pose those sorts of problems. I know that I've only just recently learnt this, but if you overwater, not to the point of death, obviously, but you're getting good, healthy plants, because they're getting sufficient water in the topsoil, because you're watering so frequently, they don't drive their tap root down searching for water.
I suppose they go to the easiest source of where they're getting what they need.
Exactly. So they develop a good top structure of roots, but they don't drive that tap root down.
Yeah.
Now, then if you take the water away from them, they don't have that structure, the tap root, to sustain through the heat, because they don't have that other source.
Yeah, where... it makes perfect sense, and then they just perish. Yeah.
Yeah, because obviously the top layers dry out quicker than the deeper layers.
Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense, I suppose. And yeah, well, it's just there, really. Like, if it's getting water easily from surface water as a general thing, it will have its roots up there. And if it's not, it will go down and try and get towards that water table. And
yeah, it'll search for it. And also, obviously, the deeper the ground, the it doesn't dry out as much. So
yeah, because it retains its moisture for longer.
Exactly. So, yeah. You know, in part, that was a good, valuable lesson that I learnt again, was that I had been overwatering. So obviously, I hadn't been overwatering to the point where the plants were suffering. It's just that I babied them and held their hand too much, and I didn't allow their tap roots to develop as much, and therefore they suffered in the long run.
And I suppose that's also something that you learn when you're experimenting with growing plants in the ground and in pots. And it also depends on the type of soil that you've got in the ground, whether mm-hmm. it's well-drained soil or if it's clay or whatever, that, you know, the amount that you need to water varies. Like, if you're used to having plants in the ground, and you might only have to water them periodically, whereas then you start growing something in a pot and think you don't need to grow it as often. And like you said, the formidable Queensland sun, they can just...
It dries the whole pot out.
Exactly, and they don't last nearly as long.
Yeah, that's right. So you really do have to look at your site and situation and sort of accommodate. So
it's all a learning curve, and, you know, that's why we're doing it, and, you know...
Well, that's why we're talking about it, yeah. Isn't it? So, however, because of that situation, I then just decided to pull everything out. Whether it was ready for harvesting or not, I ripped everything out, and I posted a Twitter poster on there. But, you know, I got a fairly decent selection of carrots, albeit small, but, you know, fairly good crop of carrots out of it, excluding the ones that I took with me, which I'll allow to mature a lot more. And a few decent beetroots and a whole lot of purple king climbing beans, which I'll be making into a baked bean mix.
Oh yeah, that'll be interesting.
But we enjoyed some of those tomato.
We sure did. You threw a few of those carrots and beetroot and bits and pieces in a roasting tin in the oven, and it was magic, mate. It really was. Yeah. I'd never had roast beetroot before.
Neither. Not
I've always
like
been
that.
A big fan of it in the sliced pickled type form that you have on a sandwich or whatever. But yeah, it was really enjoyable, and it's something I'm definitely going to get into in the ground at my place. So.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, mate, I'm not a big fan of the pickled, sliced, pre-prepared beetroot that you get on your Aussie burgers so much.
Yep.
In fact, I hate it. I can't stand it.
Wow.
I know it's very un-Australian of me.
Didn't pick you for a hater.
Not a hater, a disliker.
Fair enough.
Can we go with that?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's out there now.
Yeah, well, you know.
The genie's out of the bottle.
We'll let the community decide on that. But I've got to say, for someone who doesn't like it, and, you know, that, I dare say it, there's a lot of people out there in the same boat. But there is not, they're in two different worlds, having fresh beetroot, straight out, I'll keep them in the fridge.
Yeah.
And I'll even just, you know, I'll peel it with the peeler, and then I'll use the peeler to actually slice the beetroot as well, and having that on a sandwich and whatnot, or even just eating it fresh. It's absolutely, you know, gorgeous, just raw.
It is. It's a really beautiful vegetable. It's great colour, great flavour and texture, and then having it raw, which is the only way I'd ever had fresh beetroot before, and then you roasted some the other night,
well,
and it was
roasting
magic.
It took it into another world of its own as well.
It did, yeah.
You know, so I'm really looking forward. I think I've got about four or five left, and you know, just peeling them, cutting them half, putting them in a roasting tray, and enjoying it. So
very versatile vegetable, and one that people probably wouldn't think is versatile.
And I've got to tell you, it was the easiest to grow out of everything I
grew. Yeah, I've grown them once in the past, and it was fairly fairly forgiving.
Sprinkled it in and let them go, and I didn't even pull the smaller ones out to give the bigger ones space. So when I did pull them out, there was a few that just didn't even develop. There's just a little plant that hadn't developed a,
you know, overshadowed by the stronger one next to it or something.
Yeah, and I probably should have pulled them out, but by that stage I'd started to look at other things, and I was a bit lazy and a bit careless, and they were growing so easily I didn't really care, and that's fine. But, you know, to the beetroot's credit, it carried on, and things were eating it as well, and it kept up.
Kept on trucking.
That's it. So I guess that is the, that's why it's such an Australian vegetable.
Yeah.
Hey, another thing. I returned to work, and I put a post out on our website. You can go and read this, but real quick. First appointment I had, I jumped into the back of my car and opened up one of the boxes where I keep a bunch of stuff for work. And I'd previously been storing these boxes in my shed, my new shed. Whilst we moved in, I was obviously using the car to move. I put the boxes from the shed back in the car. And first appointment, opened the box up. Inside, little lizard.
Oh, wow. What type?
Not sure. I think it was a blue tongue.
Oh, cool.
Because of its shape and the size of its tail, it had a really short, stumpy tail.
Yeah, right.
But it almost looked like a skink.
Yeah, okay.
But I've never seen a skink with a short, pencil-like tail. So I've posted pictures on our website.
Yeah.
Jump over and have a look. The reason I bring it up is I would love for people to be able to tell me what kind of lizard it is. Because my immediate reaction was it's a blue tongue, and I work in the veterinary industry, and I was fortunate enough to take it in to one of the vets there, and they thought, yeah, maybe it is a blue tongue as well. It didn't stick its tongue out and say, hey, this is me, I'm a blue tongue. But its patterns don't look too much like a blue tongue, and its actual abdomen...
But often juveniles in any species don't look like what their adult form looks
that's
like.
That's right. Although, in saying that, I typed in, you know, young blue tongue, baby blue tongue into the search engine, and all the pictures I saw there, none of them looked like it.
Oh, wow, okay.
So, now I don't really know what it is at all. So, I'd love for people to be able to have a look, and if there's any lizard experts out there, or people who just have a keen interest in reptiles, and they know what it is, I'd love to know what it was, because I actually nurtured it from the Sunshine Coast all the way back down to Brisbane, and carried it around with me to every appointment.
Wow.
Into every... I didn't want to lock it in the car and then...
Pocket lizard.
Yeah, it was in a box with some bark.
You probably climbed in the car to get a bit of warmth.
Yeah, yeah, and then here I am with the aircon on. but I did have visions of it just baking in the car, so I did carry it in with me, and I work in the veterinary industry, so they were all keen to see it. And
oh, cool.
It made my first day back at work a little more enjoyable, which can often be a stressful day.
Absolutely. It's always tough coming back from holidays.
But I did let it go back out in the garden next to the shed, so hopefully it sort of has... You know, an idea of where it is, and it just sort of, so it was Liz's day out.
Yes, well, that's right, just like Ferris Bueller.
Yes. So, it was a good day.
Oh, good stuff.
So, I've got some pickled onions in my fridge.
Yes, my beautiful wife Dee, she's been doing lots of creative things in the kitchen, and one of which was doing up a big batch of pickled onions.
Mm.
And I've got to say, I'm a pretty big fan of the old pickled onion, and she did a did a damn good job. So we've sort of hoed into the ones that she's made. She's given lots away, and we'll probably tweak the recipe just a little bit. But you know, it was great fun. It actually the recipe came from my nana, and my mum made some, and they were really, really beautiful. And we got the recipe off my mum, so keeping the family tradition going.
That's good.
And yeah, it was really nice. Dee got some pickling jars off the internet that a lovely old lady passed on to us. And they're the old school ones.
They
that,
are awesome.
Yeah, they're pretty pretty retro.
We might take a photo and chuck.
Yeah, we should do that. Yeah, we'll whack a photo up. But yeah, Dee's been doing some great things in the kitchen. That's one
just
of them.
On the pickled onions. Thank you for them, by the way.
No worries.
But I didn't know whether now's the time to eat them or whether I need to let them pickle for a bit.
Yeah, they were. I think they said once they're, because there's a process that they go through before they make their way into the jar, obviously, yep. And it's a few days soaking, and then they get done. The drafts get sterilised, and then the pickling liquid gets heated and boiled, mm-hmm. and then poured in over the onions. I think they only need to stay in the jar for a couple of days.
Yeah.
After they're done, I don't think it would be to their detriment if they stayed longer. That's one of the beauties of it. It's a type of preserve, really. Mm. They probably wouldn't want to be left there forever in a day because it's nice to still have a bit of crunch in your pickled onion. But yeah, they'd be good to go, mate, I reckon.
Well, I'm going to get into them because it's one of my favourite things. And I must say, if it hadn't been for my father, because my mother and my two sisters all hate this, anything pickled, really, and olives and any of that sort of stuff.
Mm.
But my old man, you know, obviously loves that stuff. Gherkins, a whole lot.
Yeah, it's all good. I'm a big fan of all of it, actually.
Yeah, so we pretty much had it in the fridge constantly. Religiously, we always had pickled stuffs, and pickled onions was something I just loved it. I'd go through stages when I was growing up. You know, I'd eat the whole thing in one go, or then I'd peel the layers off and eat a layer by layer by layer until you get to the tiny little slither in the middle. And then I'd go back to just eating the whole thing and, you know.
Yeah, I was always a bit of a fan of them. We didn't have them all the time, but it was always a nice change up from the old peanut butter or Vegemite sandwich to have a cheese and pickled onion sandwich at school.
Yeah.
And, yeah, fond memories as a youngster of having that, and I'm still a bit of a fan of it now, I'll confess. It's good fodder.
I want to have one now.
All a good time.
Yeah. So what else? What else you've been pop?
So she did that. Dee made that and did really well, and we'll definitely be doing them again. Mm-hmm. But another one that she did, which was absolutely magic, and I had some on my steak tonight, was a beautiful chili jam. And Dee is not a big fan of super spicy stuff.
Yeah.
In fact, she's not a fan of even mildly spicy stuff, but she did this chili jam and it was absolutely beautiful.
Is it quite hot?
No, it's not. It's warm. It's got a gentle glow.
So a gentle glow between you and I is considered hot too?
Not really. Well then, it's pretty mild, but it has the flavors there. It's absolutely magic. And I said to Dee, we could at least double the chili in that.
Yep. So what else went into it?
A lot of tomatoes, sugar, onions.
Yep.
I'm not sure I didn't make it.
All good stuff.
But yeah, it, mate, on a steak, I had a beautiful piece of rump steak tonight, covered with caramelised onions and then dumped chilli jam on it with a bit of salt and pepper. Whew. Good living.
Yeah,
it was the bomb.
I did smell it when I was over at your place, and it smelled absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, no, it was magic. I think we could do with dosing the chili up a bit. Saying that, Dee hasn't eaten much of it, and I said, it's so good, you've got to try a bit on your steak. And she had a tiny bit and was like, oh, God, that's so spicy. And I'm like, it's not really.
We have to make two batches then.
Yeah, that's right. So we're going to have to do a spicy, you know.
Well, maybe I have the little bird's eye chili down there, and I would gladly donate some if I could get a jar of it.
Definitely, yeah. No, we're going to get that in the mix again, and it the flavour was just top notch. It really, really was good, and but I reckon it could have just been.
While we're on the subject of chilies, what's I had a couple of small jalapeno chili bushes.
Mm.
Seedlings, I should say. And I gave you one. What happened to it?
It's still there. It's still there. It probably hasn't been getting as much TLC as it should have. So it's about the same size, but it's still going well. I've got to get it in the ground. Yep. My one that's in the ground, even though it's in getting harassed by the chooks on a minute basis, it's still finally
yep.
started to steal up a bit and showing some growth and fruiting some chilies.
Excellent.
This one I want to chuck on the other side of the fence in the safe zone.
So it's still in a pot, is it?
Yeah, it's still in the, it's still in the pot that we, put in that night. So yeah, it hasn't moved. Still there. Still kicking.
Yep.
I've got to get that into the ground. But yeah, I want to get a few jalapenos going. You've got a few really healthy looking ones that are producing some fruit. I'm a big fan of the pickle. We were talking about pickled onions before. I'm a really big fan of the sliced pickled jalapenos.
Me
they're,
too.
They're good on so many things. And they're quite expensive to buy at the supermarket.
Very.
And
very.
Like all those sort of preserves and things, I think it's probably quite a simple process to get that flavour and that result yourself. And that's definitely on my to-do list.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big fan of pickled jalapenos.
Yeah,
they're magic. I have them on salad. I have them on ham and lettuce tomato sandwiches. I have them on by themselves, straight out of the jar. I even use the pickling oil once in a soup. Just
the brine. Right.
Just a few spoonfuls to get some of that, and boy, it was hot.
Mm.
Even though they're not actually that hot of a chili, but that. A pickling
rind. Funnily enough, they're actually considered quite a hot chili if they're left to go red on the bush. Most of the time, the pickled ones are a green version.
Yeah.
And they go through a whole range of colours from, I think they start off at almost like a black, then they go to green, then they go to red, and when when they're left to go to red, they're up there on the heat scale of the chili.
Okay, I didn't actually know that. I always thought, I just assumed they were green.
And the reason that I knew that is because when I bought my seedling, it was called a jalapeno fire eater, and it had a picture of a red chili, and I was like, is this a different variety? And I've looked into it a little bit, and no, that's the process that it goes through. So picking at different stages of the fruit's development gives a different heat rating. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Learning.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So what else have you been making, or had made for you, fortunately?
Yes, very fortunate. So we've had the beautiful chili jam and the pickled onions. And another thing we planted a couple of weeks back was a whole heap of herbs. And
we spoke about this on a previous story.
Of all those herbs, they're all doing pretty well. But one in particular, the basil's just going off the chart. It's really, you know, so Dee's thought, well, what can we start making out of this? So she put together the other night a beautiful homemade pesto pasta.
Yep.
And it was just fantastic.
Excellent.
So,
I love pesto. It's one of my favourite condiment. You call it condiment, won't you?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Ingredient.
It's good.
Yeah. It's...
It is good. So yeah, Dee made that up. So she's been really creative in the kitchen and using bits and pieces that we've had from home and that we've grown and things like that. It just makes it that much sweeter and tastier. That you know, it's a real sense of satisfaction when you can turn the raw ingredients into a beautiful meal. And you know, it's really excellent. And
I love basil too.
Basil's beautiful. Another thing we use it in actually is we whipped up a bit of fresh bruschetta.
Had
that on some nice Turkish bread with some beautiful tomatoes and onion and olive oil. And, oh, mate, so good.
Yeah, and I'd love to...
so fresh.
I love bruschetta, and because it's got all my favourite ingredients.
Yeah.
Things like basil, things like tomato, things like onion.
And that fresh basil in there, it just...
It lifts it, doesn't it?
It really just takes it to another level,
we should make a little goal that we should be able to make our own bruschetta from scratch, from everything, all the raw ingredients, and then make our own bread. That's another thing. I'm all prepped to go as well, so I'm going to take you through bread making as
well. Yes, that was one of my New Year's resolutions is to start making a bit of my own bread.
Yep.
And that's something I haven't done yet, and we've already lost a quarter of the year, so...
Well,
I've got to pull my finger out there.
Yes. Well, my New Year's resolution was to give blood at least twice in the year, and I've done it once, so I'm already halfway there. So,
well played.
I'm not gloating, but you can see the size of my gloating smile.
Just have to move this microphone. You're about to bump into it.
Yeah. So we'll get that. We'll actually do a little video on that as well. That's Joel's New Year's resolution coming to fruition.
Yep.
And I'll be glad to pass on my recipes. I've got, I mean, it's so simple, making bread. It really is. When I show you how easy it is, you're going to kick yourself for not starting earlier. But I've got a great recipe that does 6 white burger rolls.
Big fan of a white burger roll. Yeah. Actually, I love doing things in the barbie and having them on a fresh hamburger.
Exactly.
Roll.
And the reason I mention half a dozen is because I always find that if you get a dozen bread rolls, you eat about 8 of them, and then you've got 4 which you end up toasting or something because they're starting to go. And making 6, you enjoy them while they're fresh, and then
it's a good number.
Make
yeah.
another. So, and obviously a few others as well. And even to the point of making my own sourdough starter, which I've got to kick off here again because I unfortunately let the other one go sour.
Dope.
But yeah, it's a really cool process as well. It takes 7 days to get your sourdough starter, and that's essentially capturing and growing the natural yeasts that's in the air, and actually they're attracted and they feed on the flour and water mixture in the jar, and you sort of nurture it and feed it over 7 days, and then you can make sourdough from scratch without using any bought yeast or anything. So you just flour, water, a bit of salt, and the sourdough
using
starter.
Fresh yeast has been a bit of a revelation to us at home. Once again, D, at home, making some beautiful meals, started using it, making some homemade pizza bases.
Yeah.
And, Jesus, they really were beautiful.
Yeah.
And, she'd never used it before, and I obviously hadn't either, and she got some, and the results were just fantastic. So yeah.
Fresh pizza dough with 3 ingredients, you know, basil, tomato, bit of sauce, a little bit of mozzarella, just the couple of ingredients. It beats anything you can get in the store.
Often, so. And you're right there with keeping it fairly simple. It sometimes if you put too many ingredients on it, in their own right, they're all a beautiful ingredient, but it makes it too busy. Yeah. Whereas just having a few simple ingredients, I've been to Rome once, luckily enough, and the pizza over there was just absolutely magic, and that's what it was. It was just very simple, 2 or 3 ingredients on a beautiful base.
That's the secret to pizza.
Yeah.
I hate pizza unless it's made like that.
Yeah, no, it's good stuff.
So the best pizza I've ever had actually was some New Yorkers who moved from New York to Santa Monica, and there's a little pizza place over there. That's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
All right, last thing I wanted to ask you about. When we went into the ABC radio interview, we actually took Rebecca Levingston some eggs that you had, stolen from Chook's bums.
Yeah, straight from the Chook's bum, quote unquote.
Yeah. Now, what Rebecca didn't know was that originally the 6 eggs that were going to go to her, there was a white egg in there, but your little boy, Jacob, he said, no, not the white egg, not the white egg, because you've been getting brown eggs.
Nothing but brown eggs, and all of a sudden, a very white egg turned up. And one of the episodes previous, I was speaking about the Chooks, and I thought there was one that was possibly slightly different breed. I think she's throwing this white egg, so I spoke about trying to separate her to see if she was laying, because I had a feeling that she wasn't, and I haven't got around to doing that yet. But just interesting that this one white egg arrived in a clutch.
Have you had a few now, or have you just got the one?
I've only seen the one so far. So, yeah, it could be something that's not going to happen all the time. Like, we're getting pretty much 5 or 6 eggs a day.
You've got 6 so far?
Yeah, we're getting 6.
Previously when we spoke, you'd only had up to 5.
Yeah, no, we're definitely getting quite a few days now. We are getting 6, so
that's awesome.
Yeah, it is awesome. And the other one that my little bloke held off from Rebecca too was a double yoker that we had. So sorry about that, but
sorry about that.
I'm sure she enjoyed the eggs that she did get. And I'm certainly still enjoying munching down on them. They're
excellent.
They're beautiful.
Well, with that, we'll end the show. Don't forget to jump over to our website, theurbanfarmers.tv, and that's got all of our contact details, including our Twitter feed, which is where we do a lot of posting as well as the website. You can jump onto Twitter and find us at Urban Farmers TV. And we'll leave you now with the ABC radio interview that we've mentioned. And I hope you enjoy the show and continue to follow us.
And yeah, stay tuned on the website because we're going to start. We've had a very busy period between the two of us in our own right at the moment, but we are going to be putting a few more videos together and posting them up. So stay tuned for those because we haven't had a chance to do too many just of late, but we've got plenty on the drawing board waiting to get filmed. So stay posted for that.
We'll start with those pickled onions. Go get your hands dirty.
See you later.
G'day, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Really well. And thank you so much for my fresh chook eggs, Joel.
No, no worries. Happy Easter.
Straight from the chook's bum?
Yeah, straight from there.
The best kind. Now, chicken poo and worm mansions, these are the things you say are at the heart of what makes you happy. Joel, Jim, you're a businessman, right?
Yeah, I work in the corporate lifestyle, white-collar position. So
why do you want to be around chicken poo and worm mansions?
Well, I think specifically the chicken poo is probably not quite what makes us happy, but it's what it can do for us, using it in the garden to help nourish our vegetables and things like that and bring them to life and nurture them to a fully grown fruit and vegetable that we can enjoy in the kitchen. So,
you guys have a big story to tell, so let's go back to the start. Joel, you're two blokes from Brisbane, you're best mates. How did you first become friends?
Well, Jimmy and I met when we were about nine and we used to play rugby union together and we've been mates ever since. We've sort of drifted on different paths at times, but we've always remained solid mates. And yeah, we were discussing some other interests of ours a while back and we both really... we're interested in moving to the country and trying to get a bit of land and produce our own fruit and vegetables and food to whatever degree we could. And we were sort of putting that off, thinking when we can move away, we'll do this and that. And the reality was that with work commitments and family and life, we were in Brisbane and we started looking at other options of what we could do in our own backyard that we'd sort of overlooked.
Yeah, I think... just on that, the main thing was that we kept dreaming about that. And, you know, I guess there was that element of, you know, I'd be happy when that happens or I'd be happy if that happens. And, you know, it just came to a realisation that why keep putting it off? You know, we don't have that accessibility to that lifestyle, but there's nothing stopping us from incorporating those ideals in our suburban situation. And ever since then, you know, we've just been having a plug at it and it's been so rewarding, you know, growing your own fruit and vegetables with whatever space that's available to you. And I think that there's a lot of people interested in that sort of lifestyle as well. And, you know,
you mentioned you hold down a white collar job in a business environment. Do you get satisfaction from that?
Yeah, it's a fairly high stress position in the fact that, you know, there's a lot of priorities always on the go and you go all the time. So To come home of an afternoon and just take half an hour, an hour, and just go out into the garden and get your hands dirty, it's kind of an escapism, if you will. But long term, you know, that's a short term thing where you can escape from that lifestyle. But long term, when you start reaping the rewards of being out in the garden and using that produce to cook with and enjoying those meals is ultimate satisfaction.
Joel, what sort of work do you do?
I'm a plumber. Yeah, so I work for myself and, it's work. You've got to do something. I dreamed about moving away for a long time and then, like Jimmy said, we just sort of looked more at what we were overlooking in our own backyard and...
But why couldn't you just pack up and go? A skill set of a plumber is needed in every country town in Queensland. Why wouldn't you just take your wife and two kids and head north or west?
Well, I think that's a bit easier said than done. You know, I probably could do that. But reality is that I've got a network of people that I know in Brisbane and that's where my work is. It probably is a bit of a comfort thing, but it's easier to stay where the work is at the moment and also where our friends and family are. And look, maybe down the track we will progress and move to there. That is something I'd still like to do. But for now...
we're in the city and, you know, our little bloke's in school and, you know, it's just the right thing for us to be here at the moment. And, you know, we realised that there was more we could be doing in our own backyard, and it didn't all have to be put off for tomorrow or if and when that ever came.
You're listening to Joel and Jim. They call themselves the Urban Farmers, two friends who decided they wanted to make a real change to the way they lived their lives in suburban Brisbane. In fact, they wanted to live more like they were living in the country. So what was the first thing you did, Jim, to really make a change?
I dug up a garden that had flowers in it and replaced it with some vegetables. So it was a fairly modest little attempt at it. But in the situation I was at, I didn't have, I guess, the authority to be digging up all of the gardens and changing it all to a productive suite of vegetables. But, you know, that was the first step, is just trying that out. And also growing some things in some pots and stuff like that that's transportable. So if I did move, I could take them with me. So I guess that's probably the easiest step to do. And a lot of people, you know, even if they're in an apartment, can start growing things on their balcony and containers and things like that. So that was really the first step. And then it just, you know, once you get the bug, you got to keep going with it. So,
Joel, what about you? You're a dad. You've got two sons. Busy time. How do you find the time to be tending to veggie patches when you're working long hours as a plumber?
It is difficult finding the time, and to be honest, I haven't been spending as much time doing it as I'd like. But you can also achieve a bit with only a limited amount of time. And I think that's one of the main things Jim and I are trying to, you know, make people aware of, is that you don't need to have acres and acres of land, and you don't need to be spending sun up to sundown, you know, tending that land to get something out of it. You know, we, Jim and I both work long hours, but you know, the limited time you can put into it, you can still get some really great benefits out of it. And it, with a little bit of time and effort, you can make a small backyard, a balcony, or a reasonable sized backyard into something really productive.
You're an unlikely pair. A corporate high flyer, a plumber, and you're talking in quite sensitive terms about a change to your philosophy in life. Mm. How did your family and friends respond to your quest to become urban farmers?
Well, for me, it's been fairly well embraced, actually. In fact, I mentioned that I was in temporary housing or temporary location prior, but I've just purchased a house with my twin brother, and you know, we've got a share, and I'm right into all of this, and he's got other interests, and you know, he's allowed me to take over a portion of the backyard, or plan to take over a portion of the backyard.
Does he get to eat the crops?
Well, he's a chef, so if he doesn't eat them, I'll sure be making him prepare them for
cook
me.
With
so
him. You're a good pair.
Yeah.
What about you, Joel? Family and friends, what did they think when you said, "Oh, look, I'm a plumber, but I would just want to get my hands in the dirt on the weekends"?
Yeah, it's something I've been interested in for a long time. I'd love to actually be out there working on a farm, really, but so I guess it didn't come as too much of a surprise to them. But I, you know, I enjoy it, and the family's getting a lot out of it too. My wife and my two boys, we're all enjoying the fresh produce and particularly the eggs that we're getting from our chooks. And it's really rewarding, and it's something that anyone can do, really. Virtually anyone can do with a small backyard. They can turn it into something productive, and it's really rewarding.
And you're not doing this for any financial reward. It's not like you've got any sponsors or anything like that. You're just doing this because it's something that is at the heart of what makes you happy.
Yeah, ultimately, when we set up the Urban Farmers, it was a way that Joel and I could really sort of document but also share our experiences and learnings during this time when we're shifting our life towards a more sustainable and self-sufficient lifestyle. But also, you know, we wanted to engage with the community as well, just so that we can learn from them as well, but hopefully also we can maybe inspire people to make, you know, positive changes like that as well. And that that's really the heart of it. There's nothing financial or you know, under the table about it. It's just we love doing it, and we love sharing, you know, the experience. And for those who are willing to listen, read or watch what we're doing, then, you know.
It's a bit of fun too. How has it changed you, Jim?
I would say that I think for me the biggest change is that rather than thinking, I'll be happy when I get it. I'm happy with what I've got. And that's, I think, the ultimate, you know, that you can achieve in life, you know, rather than, you know, pursuing a distant dream of and then deciding that you'll be content when you get that. I think being content with what you've got is a much better outlook. So that's...
And it's what everyone wants.
Absolutely.
What about you, Joel? How's it changed you?
Yeah, well, it's all positive. I think a lot of people are, you know, moving this way. There's quite a few of our friends are getting chickens and growing some veggies in the backyard. And I think it's a trend that's going to, you know, increase. There's a lot of people that, from probably my parents' generation, that used to, that was really common back then. And then it sort of got lost for a while, but... I think that it's swinging back the other way, and it's really rewarding, and I think that it's just going to increase, particularly with the cost of food and the way it's commercialised and everything now, that people will want to, you know, be doing that themselves and getting that sense of satisfaction of being able to grow it themselves.
And it's not so much about, you know, becoming so productive that you don't need to go to the store anymore. It's more about, you know, supplementing and enjoying that hard work. And I think society in our culture, the Western culture in particular, has become so comfortable that, you know, we're lazy, and maybe there's a lot of people out there that aren't happy about that anymore. You know, we're just too preoccupied with, you know, toys and technology that we've sort of lost that connection to our food and that connection to the seasons in particular as well.
Do you ever relapse, though, and just get a dirty pizza and a, you know, a slab of commercial beer and lay back in the couch?
Well...
we are only human. Yeah.
I'm pleased to hear it. All right, you've talked about veggie patches, chooks in the yard, fresh eggs. What else is next in your quest for urban self-sufficiency?
I think that some of the other elements, it's not just about food, it's also about, you know... you know, improving the way that you live as far as your energy consumption, perhaps. So looking towards more sustainable energy solutions, greener solutions, and also, you know, how we utilise our water and things like that. So I'm fortunate enough to have tank water at my new place, but solar is something that I'd certainly be looking at. So it's just about not so much getting completely off the grid, but just, you know, becoming more... I guess, in control of where you source life's essentials from.
Joel, this is going to change the way your kids view the world.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, I really hope so. There's so much trend going towards television and, you know, computer games and that sort of thing, that I think it's good to show them, you know, what life used to be like more commonly for just about everyone. And... you know, they get a lot out of it. They really enjoy it. The little boys take the scraps up to the chooks every day. They're having fun getting in the garden. They'll go and get some fresh herbs when we're cooking brekkie. And, you know, we like getting away into the bush and camping and doing that sort of thing as well. So hopefully they do. I really hope that they do get a lot out of it. And you know, they already seem to be, so.
Mm. There's a lot of joy in your son's eyes when he gets... He's running down with the fresh eggs in his hand. So.
Yeah.
There is not a kid on the earth who doesn't get excited when an egg emerges from a chook's bum. That is for sure. Guys, it's been lovely having you in tonight. And as I said, you're an unlikely pair, a corporate high flyer, a plumber, and you're getting back to basics. Thanks so much for sharing your story.
No worries. Thanks for the time.
That's Joel and Jim, and they call themselves the Urban Farmers. If you want to follow along with their adventures, you can. You can see some videos they've put online, a blog they have online as well. Their website is theurbanfarmers.tv.